Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
And that was Ann.
And that's me.
And she's got that frog again. She had last week. But I'm sure it'll go away in a little bit. Because this is a very sweet program today.
Oh, is it all sweet?
Well, it is, actually, isn't it? Well, if you count the last track, tomatoes as a fruit.
Oh, okay. I knew there was a catch.
Then I guess it's all sweet. It's in alphabetical order, and it's mostly ladies today, too.
Yeah.
Another guy called Peter snuck in there.
Yes.
but other than that, it's the distaff side is in charge, as rightly should be so, I guess.
You know, it's rather difficult even to conceive of a new, brand new and exciting cookie idea, but Joanne Adoram actually did that. She came up with a cross between a chip and a cookie called cookie chips, and they are truly addictive. Let's listen to Joanne.
I would say that the world has probably more cookies than it needs, except for I just tasted a new one, which I'm in love with, which is the cookie chips. We were talking to the founder and CEO of this company, Joanne Adoram, and you're in California, right?
Yes.
Right. And how are we going to sort this through? First of all, these showed up at the Fancy Food Show in San Francisco, and so someone sent us samples. And I love cookies, but I'm really surprised to get one that I haven't had before. There's so many on the market. But these are wonderful. They're halfway a cookie and halfway a chip. Explain what the concept is.
Well, what I did, I'll just give you a little history really quick. So I've been baking for a long time. My company is 20 years old, and we've been making lots of different kinds of cookies and cakes and pies and you name it, we make it. And a lot of the cookies that we make today professionally for customers are typically more in the soft and chewy category. So one day at home during the summer a few years ago, I wanted just to do some baking, and I wanted to make something crunchy, so I said, let's make some crunchy chocolate chip cookies. So I made some crunchy chocolate chip cookies, and my two kids were at home, and they just devoured them. They loved them, particularly my daughter, who the idea really spawned from her, who I consider, or what I call, the chip queen. She loves potato chips and chips, and she's anything that crunches, she eats. My son is not too far behind, but she's the leader of the chip eating person. So with that, I started thinking, I was like, well, I got this crunchy cookie. I have kids that love chips. I prefer that they eat something. I don't really like a lot of, you know, we're very careful. I've taught them about looking at ingredient statements and preservatives and food colorings and all that stuff. You can have some junk food in reason and go, try to stay away from the really bad stuff. So everything that I make, I really try to make very clean. And that's why the product today is an all-natural product, because it's simple, clean ingredients, just like anybody would if they had simple ingredients at home, which they typically do. So my kids love them so much. I said, is it possible to make a cross between a cookie and a chip so it's thin enough to eat like a chip, and you'd want to eat it like a chip, but it's still a cookie because I'm a pastry chef. So as a pastry chef, I'm really interested in making sweet things and not tortilla chips or potato chips.
Well, now, hold on just a second,
sure,
Joanne, because if you use the British and French term for what we're talking about with a regular cookie, it's called a biscuit, and a biscuit in French means cooked twice. So how is cookie chip different than a biscuit?
Well, we don't have to bake it twice.
Okay. Oh, I see.
Thank God, because that would take us a lot longer to make them. But what I had to do is I had to formulate it such in a way to get it to spread thin enough as a cookie, to be thin enough like a chip, so it would eat like a chip and be crispy like a chip, and then we'd only have to bake it one time. Bake for long. They bake like about 13 minutes on average in the oven, anywhere between 12 and 14 minutes probably.
But the secret is thin and probably high temperature too, huh?
Actually, the temperature isn't as high as you would think it would be. It's really in the formulation, and there's a secret. So that one I'm not going to reveal. That took us some time to really nail down the formulation to get it so that we can get a thin, crisp cookie.
And when you say you eat them like chips, unfortunately, that's what happened to me. I don't even have a sweet tooth, but one of them is not enough. You kind of keep eating them like you do with chips.
I know. That's the evil part of it. But it's the fun part. I mean, in snacking, you want a snack to be fun. You want the flavors to be fun. When you eat potato chips, they're fun to eat. So I wanted an equivalent in a cookie to be as fun to eat it in a similar way. And that's the feedback, actually, that we're getting. We get feedback every single day from people. We have people come in off of our snacks.com emails they send us, and they tell us the most incredible things. They call them crack cookies because they just can't stop eating them. They call them danger cookies. It's incredible what they say.
Got a hit on your hand.
It's a lot of, and you know what? I really wasn't sure it was going to happen. We did launch it last summer, and I was very excited about the launch, and I thought for sure this is going to be a really cool thing, but as we got closer to it, you don't know what the consumer or what people are, just because you love it doesn't mean everybody else is, but
right.
From the get-go, people were like, wow, this is really a really nice product, they love to eat it, the flavors are great, and
yeah, how many flavors do you have?
We have four flavors.
Okay, they are?
We have an original, which is like a plain chocolate chip cookie.
Yeah, that's the one I like.
So that's like, it's like a brown sugar crunchy cookie. You have to have chocolate chip because that is the number one cookie, period, in America. Maybe even abroad, too, because maybe you can tell me, I don't really know in terms of other countries what the number one cookie is there. But definitely here you have to have at least your basics, chocolate chip, and then wanted to do, peanut butter is wonderful, but wanted to do a little twist on that, so we added sea salt to it and made a sea salted peanut butter. Butter and cinnamon sugar, which is for me like my favorite, and people kind of compare that against a churro, which is a Spanish type of pastry with cinnamon sugar on it.
That's one of my favorite things. You're talking about the Mexican wedding cookies?
No, actually, a churro is an actual fried pastry. I don't know if you've had them. They're like sticks.
Oh, churro.
And they toss them in cinnamon sugar. So a lot of times people will say, oh, my, your cinnamon cookie chips taste like a churro.
A churro. So, okay, I know what churro is.
Now, if you're looking for what the rest of the world eats, in terms of biscuits, in England, probably ginger snaps are among the favorites, and obviously they're very crisp by the sound of it, and very thin. They also like oatmeal cookies. Now those wouldn't be they're sort of oaty and not very sweet, so they probably wouldn't get come across in the United States.
Oatmeal raisin is number two after chocolate chip, oatmeal raisin. Peanut butter, sugar cookies, those are your staples.
Well,
don't be surprised if
you
see an oatmeal raisin coming up shortly, but go ahead.
you say you're a trained pastry chef?
I'm a self-taught pastry chef.
Okay.
My background is actually very different.
You're not a historian.
We're all art historians. I figured out all of the food people.
you're probably not really an art historian. Give us the real secret. Maybe you are an art historian.
No. My background is actually in clinical psych.
That's a good thing to have if you're selling cookies.
Well, I tell people, but when I graduated high school, the whole chef thing, the whole food industry, it wasn't what it is today, which is a very glamorous industry. And everybody thinks, oh my God, I want to go to be on the Food Network. I want to be a chef. I want to do this, that, whatever. It's not always as glamorous as the TV portrays it to be. But so when I went to school, it was more about what college you're going to go to. Are you going to be a doctor? Or what kind of career in terms of that? Not in the food industry. Today, the food industry is a much bigger deal. So if I was graduating school today and going to college, I might have gone to culinary school. So I didn't take that track back then because I went more of the traditional college track.
So you say your company is 20 years old, and one of the things that struck me is right now bakery business is flourishing beyond belief in all aspects of pastries and baked goods. But 20 years ago, that wasn't the case.
No.
And you didn't have the internet, so how did you set up this company and how did it operate?
We were started up as a wholesale baking company, and I started it at the time when all the coffee house business was booming here on the West Coast. And maybe even where you are on the East Coast too, I'm not sure as much. But I'm not an original West Coaster, I'm an East Coaster or Southeast Coaster. From Florida, born and raised in Miami.
Okay.
But I've lived out here since 89, and so about 20 years ago I started the company at the time when everybody wanted to, the coffee house business, the people were putting a lot of pastries and desserts into those establishments. And I would go around and I would look and I would see and I'd say, I can do a lot better than what I'm seeing in some of these places. And it was from there, because I had a personal love, and I've been baking most of my life since a little kid. I just love to bake. So it's the moment I can open up a box of Pillsbury something. I mean, I moved on to doing more scratch baking, but over the years really taught myself how to be a baker and professional pastry chef in my business. So,
well, and you've hit now, finally, you're on trend with this all-natural, good-for-you snacks.
and snacks are the fastest growing segment of the specialty food industry.
It's huge right now. It's very interesting.
Now, the good news, listeners, is that, well, apart from the fact that there's more variety coming because there are more flavors coming, you can get cookie chips quite widely in these United States.
Yes, we are working very hard to get it in a lot of the retailers across the U.S., all kinds, from gourmet stores to major retailers to small independent, so that people have access to it. We get calls every day from people, where can I get it? How can I find it? My local store ran out of it. Is there another store I can get it at? So we really want to be able to have access for our customers who are looking for it.
Now, is there a website with a store locator?
Yes, actually, hannamax.com. They can find us on the Internet, so absolutely.
And that's hannamax.com. And
that is correct.
A combination of your two of your three children. You have a new addition named Allie that we have to figure out where to put that in.
people can buy these online, but you can also tell them where to go get them from a shop?
Yes, we would be happy to. People email us and we can tell them, if they tell us where they live, we can tell them where they can find it. We have store locator on our website. It's also not just Hannamax, but I think hannamaxsnack.com too is another way to find us. And yeah, and as we continue to branch out further, we'll continue to populate the store locator site.
There's only one downside. I hate to say this, but there is a downside, because these cookie chips are so crisp. If you drop a bag on the floor, they break. What do people do with the ones that get broken?
They love to sprinkle them over ice cream. So when they break their chips, that's what they tell us they do. They actually write us and tell us stories about how they are able to reuse the cookie chips.
Oh, thank goodness for that. I was thinking you might have to throw them away.
Okay.
No, absolutely not. Or they can take a spoon and put it in the bag and they can eat it out with a spoon.
Yeah. Good to the last sprinkle. Good to the
absolutely.
Last. Good to the last crumb.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and you're so upbeat about all of this, and I just think it's great. And
well,
I'm pleased to find yet another cookie I can love.
Well, thank you very much. It's very kind of you.
Okay, and hopefully you'll be on the East Coast for the Fancy Food Show.
We're going. We'll have a booth.
Okay, I'll see you there.
Oh, we're excited to be there. I look forward to seeing you.
Oh, great. Thanks, Jillian.
Well, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
All right, you guys take care. It was a lot of fun.
And we'll be right back with more sweet stuff right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, we're back. And to answer your question as to why the next track is Polish classic desserts versus Scandinavian classic desserts, it's alphabetical order, which is why Tea for Tomatoes comes after that. But anyway, Polish cuisine seems to be front and center right now, something it hasn't been for a very long time, if ever, right, sweetheart?
Yes, that's true.
In fact, you said that on the introduction to the interview.
Exactly, I did. So why don't we listen to the interview?
All right. Here's Polish classic desserts for anyone who has a sweet tooth.
My. I really believe there's some hidden thing going on, some phenomenon that accounts for the fact that I am getting Polish cookbook in triplets. I have my third one here, which is different. We're going to talk about that from the others I've had, because its mission is different. It's called Polish Classic Desserts, written by Law and Peter Zaransky. And you're not updating, you're not modernizing. You're modernizing a little bit to make these doable desserts, but you're really preserving these great, treasured, much-loved, traditional Polish desserts. Am I correct?
Yes, absolutely. All of our recipes have been handed down from our families and from other families that have contributed, and the only thing Laura has done is update them for modern tools.
You tested all these, didn't you?
I tested all of the recipes, and I tried to use all the modern conveniences that we have, the KitchenAid blenders and mixers and those kinds of things, and we tried to make sure that all of the ingredients are things that people conveniently buy in their grocery stores or the specialty stores that are nearby these days.
I made a chocolate cream cordial yesterday for a book release party, and I used an immersion blender instead of a whisk, and it was much better.
Oh, good. I think you're right on target that this is something that's much needed, because, as I told you, my daughter-in-law is Polish. Her babcia, her grandmother, cooked all these wonderful Polish foods. Her mother never cooked anything, not at all. And as a result, my daughter-in-law knows nothing about it. So I hurriedly provide her with these so that our grandchildren will have some of their heritage.
Yeah, we spend a lot of time at Polish church craft fairs and events like that, and people always come up to us, and they either love our book as a gift for the younger generations, or they keep it for themselves to remind themselves of the recipes and the foods that they grew up with.
Yeah, now this is laced with all kinds of memories and great moments in life. Polish food, I mean food in general, I suppose, but in Poland, food is very tied to family traditions, holidays, emotional ties.
That's absolutely correct. There are many of the desserts in the book that are tied to Christmas, such as the kolaczki, the fruit-filled, very delicate cookies, ginger hearts, which is a flavor for Christmas, and poppy seed rolls. Those are some of the most traditional dishes. And then there are the cheesecakes and the baba and the mazurkas that are also for Easter. And the Easter mazurkas are really very flavorful dishes. They have a shortbread crust and are filled with nuts or an icing, a meringue, or chocolate. They're just very traditional and very, very, very wonderful tasting.
These are not diet foods.
Definitely not. They are less sweet than most American desserts, but they certainly are still full of butter and nuts and things that are still caloric.
So. But everything in moderation.
Yes.
Well, now, listeners, we should underline that Peter and Laura are, in a sense, they're the real deal, because they were not born in Poland, they were displaced from Poland, but they grew up with Polish parents, probably some Polish grandparents around there too. And
oh, absolutely! My family traces its history in Poland back to the 13th century, and Laura's been cooking these foods for over 40 years.
But you grew up here in On the Menu's home of Pittsburgh, which in many respects is Warsaw West.
Yeah, Polish Hill and the church up there on the hill. I used to know people up there, and there's a wonderful Polish community in Pittsburgh. And it's interesting, there are over 10 million Polish Americans in the U.S. alone. And these are all folks that love the food.
Yeah, well, I've judged pierogi contests.
and she's lived to tell the tale.
Yeah, I can't get my head around pierogies. I think if you had them homemade, but these were supposed to be homemade, but I think that I felt like I was swallowing rocks. I mean,
some of them can be a little heavy.
Yes.
But the dough that we've used in our book is particularly light. And of course, there's always a trick to making them, because it's how you roll out the dough as well that makes them more tender and easier to swallow.
When Laura tested the pierogies, she did about 150 of them in one day, testing the different textures of the dough and different fillings. And the kitchen was just full of flour, and guess who got stuck with all the dishes?
I cannot imagine.
Now, these are specific types. You've organized your book around these types of desserts. Can you sort of explain some of them? I just learned there's a difference between torte and a cake.
Well, the tortes usually are lighter. They have, some of them don't even have flour in them. Some of them are just a nut-based layer and kind of held together by egg whites and eggs. And they're generally less sweet, and they have fillings, sweet fillings that are from either fruit or a jam that you've created. Like one of the tortes is a lemon torte, and it has a lemon filling. And the icings are much lighter than most of the American ones that we have here. The cakes that are in the book are generally fruit-topped cakes. It's a lighter batter. They're usually a flatter rectangular or round flat cake with fruit toppings or a crumble on top that is sugar and flour that's been mixed with butter.
One of the things that characterizes some Polish desserts is the use of poppy seed. And we have a torte in our book called a poppy seed torte, which is beautiful white icing with raspberry, little raspberry squiggles on top and a layer of jam in the middle. But what's cool about this is that there's an old wives' tale that poppy seeds are a good luck food, and that they're especially used during weddings in the countryside of Poland, where poppy-filled food would be saying is good luck to the married couple. This tort also tastes delicious.
Did you follow the tale of the poor young mother who had her baby taken away from her in the hospital because she tested positive for drugs?
Yeah, well, you would have to eat an awful lot of dried poppy seeds to come even close to that.
Yeah.
Although we have heard that tale before.
Now, what about cheesecake? There are several cheesecakes now.
Oh, my God, cheesecakes.
I thought the New Yorkers thought they invented cheesecake.
No. These are quite different from New York cheesecake. For one, there is one cheesecake in here that the secret ingredient is mashed potatoes.
Really?
And it is lightest cheesecake you are ever going to want to eat.
I missed that one.
And there's
is that the Easter cheesecake?
No, that's Grandma's, I think.
Oh, it's Grandma's cheesecake. Bobcha's cheesecake.
And the Easter cheesecake is a crust that's similar to our New York cheesecakes, but a little bit lighter. And then it has a layer of jam, and then you put the cheese filling in, and the cheese filling is laced with orange rind and kind of citrusy taste, so that it's got this great combination with the raspberry and the orange together. It's just great, and everybody loves it.
I bet. What's not to love with all this stuff?
I
don't bake at all. I would wish for you just to come and fix it for me.
that can be arranged.
The cheesecake with the potatoes in it is the Krakow cheesecake.
Okay, I saw that.
And it's, again, it has a lot of the light orange and lemon zest in it, and it's just really, really flavorful.
Well, Krakow has a wonderful heritage, culinarily. We were there a couple of years ago, and one of the cool things about how friendly everybody is we were walking down the street in front of one of the major churches of Krakow, and we were invited to crash a wedding.
Oh, wow.
And so we were just able, and people were carrying the different cakes and torts and for the reception afterwards. So that was great fun, because it was not only a gorgeous church, but we got to see an authentic Polish wedding.
Do they have great restaurants?
Oh, absolutely. There's a restaurant in Warsaw that's probably 600 or 700 years old, and it's all rock lined, and it's in a basement, and you have to sort of lower your head when you go through the doorway, because people were a lot shorter back then. And I had a meal there when I was 18 that was to die for, and then we had another meal there 2 or 3 years ago when we took our daughter and son-in-law, and the place is still to die for.
Well, I mean, I think that this there is a definite audience for this cookbook. Again, it's called Polish Classic Desserts, and the authors are Laura and Peter Zaranski. The photographs, by the way, I have to mention, are just luscious.
Well, thank you. Bob Rock is a very talented photographer whom I found on Craigslist, of all things.
Wow.
He's actually an amateur with 30 years standing. He was an executive in the printing business, but always an amateur photographer, and he wanted to shoot food. And he won the shoot-off, as they say.
He certainly did. All the food actually looks not only luscious, but actually light.
Some of it is very light. Yeah, the crepes are the fruit-filled crepes are not heavy at all.
Well, it all looks just luscious. I guess I'll go have more salad.
I'll tell you a real quick story. One of the desserts in here is a papal cream cake, which is on page 73, if you happen to have
John
the book in
Paul.
Front of you. And it was a favorite of Pope John Paul II, who your audience may remember, had a Polish background. And when we were in Poland, our son-in-law, we actually went to visit the home in which the Pope grew up, his childhood home, and they were selling these papal cream cakes on the street from vendors, just little bakery carts on the street. So our son-in-law went over there, and he tried one, and he absolutely fell in love with them. So for the rest of the trip, regardless of where in Poland we were, every day he would find a bakery and get a papal cream cake or two or three.
Well, as I said, good luck with your book, and happy eating.
Thank you so much.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, thank you for staying with us. And as promised, we now bring you, in addition to the previous Polish classic desserts, we're turning to Scandinavia, well known for their desserts, presenting the new book on them called Scandinavian Classic Desserts. Here we go. Now, Pat Sinclair
is not Scandinavian, but she seems to be writing a lot about Scandinavian baking and Scandinavian classic desserts, which is the book we're going to be talking to her about. And she can explain her connection to Scandinavia.
When I was asked to do this book, I started looking through my recipe files, and I realized that there were an awful lot of recipes that I had been making for many years, because we live in Minnesota, and there's a lot of Scandinavians up here, and a lot of the recipes that you see, you know, at kitchen potluck and sort that sort of thing, have the Scandinavian heritage. And I had also worked on, it was a collection of recipes for the Lutheran Brotherhood, which is a fraternal organization. And so I had, their members submitted over 450 recipes. And so I had read all those recipes and then selected some and tested them and put together a cookbook. So I really knew a lot about the Scandinavian traditions.
Uh-huh.
And that kind of is how I got started with this, and then I've learned even more since I've been doing these books.
I have to tell you that I opened this book with some trepidation because, let's see, we've interviewed, we have, what's his name, Rene Redzepi's book, and we interviewed Marcus Nielsen's book, and my association with Scandinavian desserts at this point involves live ants.
Oh, well, there's none of that in this book.
Thank goodness for that.
Well, I just wondered if, these are, of course, classic desserts, which is in the title. How does this relate and interact to the current direction of Scandinavian cooking and their international reputation? After all, Nama has gotten the number one restaurant in the world 2 years in a row and is a likely choice for this third year.
I don't think this is related to that very much, in the sense that these are the old traditions. They've been updated somewhat, and we're using a lot of local fresh fruit, that sort of thing. But I think that a place like Noma is cutting edge, and I think that it's probably the cuisine has evolved, which makes it really different from the old classics. And I was trying to capture more of the classics, like there's actually a chapter of traditional favorites.
Right.
And those are the things, you know, like rosettes and krupkaga, that sort of thing that requires some special implements to create them. And these are the kind of recipes that people with any Scandinavian heritage, if they don't know how to make them, that's what they're looking for. They remember their grandmother making them, and they can't do them. They grew up with these, and they love to see a book that has krumkaga. That was a question that I got a lot from the first book, is why I didn't have krumkaga in the book. And I had chosen not to do it because it requires the krumkaga iron. That was the first thing I think I did when I started on the second book.
So you were bound to determine it was going to be in there this time, right?
Oh, yes, it is.
But you were determined.
Right.
Absolutely. And I do have the Danish æbleskiver and little Swedish pancakes. I mean, these, the rosettes, these require special kinds of tools. And there's a source in the back of the book where you can get the tools if you don't have them. But I kind of avoided that for the first book, but for the second book it seemed more appropriate.
So this book is for people of this heritage that are looking to recreate with the dishes they grew up with.
I think so. I think there's also a lot of really good recipes that anybody would like a Swedish spritz cookie. It's just a delicate little cookie pressed out of a cookie press. And so it's not entirely just that Scandinavians would like it. It's just some of their traditional favorites. And there's a strawberry cream cake roll, and it's a sponge cake that's filled with whipped cream and strawberries. And that's almost American. It's almost like a jelly roll cake, but it's still reflects back on the Scandinavian heritage.
Now, this is not diet food.
Oh, no.
not hardly, right?
They use a lot of butter and a lot of whipped cream.
Lots of whipped cream. I was amazed, actually.
Yeah. There is a lot of whipped cream. And, of course, that's related to their culture and their economy. There's a lot of dairy farm. And if you have really good milk and cream, then you tend to use it in your baked goods.
And, of course, you might just sneak a little sugar in there, too.
Yes, and I would say that these recipes are for American tastes. I mean, Americans tend to like things sweeter, just in general, than Europeans, I think, at least in my opinion. And so these are to American tastes. They're maybe a little sweeter than some other things that you might find in Europe.
Now, Peter likes these little vignette, what we're going to call those, the sidebars.
Yes.
Sometimes they're cities, like our house in Denmark, or a product like hazelnut, or a museum, or other architectural monument.
Or the fascinating piece of information I gathered today, which had confused me for years, that there is a Nobel Prize for Peace, which is awarded by a Norwegian foundation, but Alfred Nobel and the main Nobel Prizes are awarded in Sweden.
Yes, and I learned that, too. Now I understand it better. There is a story behind the format of the book. This publisher, Pelican Publishing, has done a series of books in this format. And originally, they were restaurant recipes. And so you'd have the photo of the dessert. The first book was dessert, and the recipe was provided by the restaurant, and then the sidebars were about the restaurant or about the types of food or that sort of thing. When they wanted to do the Scandinavian book, we didn't really have a bunch of Scandinavian restaurants to go to and get dessert. So after giving it some thought, I suggested that we do some of the cultural history, some of the traditions, and that also, I'm kind of known for my recipes in that they're clearly written. Hopefully everyone is successful using one of the recipes. And I thought it was really important to put some information in there about hazelnuts and how to remove the skin from them or beat egg whites. And so that's why it's a combination of information about the different countries and a little bit thrown in there about tips and techniques on baking.
But you've got palaces and you've got members of the royal family, so you've got a little bit of history as well.
Absolutely. And so many people buy cookbooks just to read. They're not going to cook. They just want to sit and read about the recipes and the countries and stuff. And so I think this fits really well into that.
Oh, yeah, we agree completely. We thought we didn't realize quite what the derivation was, and I was a little puzzled because sometimes the factoid didn't really intersect with the recipe that was on the next page. But then I sort of got used to your format and realized that you were doing just exactly what you said you were. You were introducing some more information in addition to just a recipe for a dessert.
Right. And that's what I tried to do. I've been doing recipe development for over 25 years. And more people that want to bake don't have much experience in the kitchen. So it's really important that you get the details in there, that you get some markers so people understand what it's supposed to look like or what it's supposed to feel like at different points in the process.
Yeah, it's totally humbling trying to figure out what anybody knows when you're writing a cook.
It really is. Yeah. That's right. And you can go from one extreme to the other. Some cookbooks are written with so many directions. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? And if it's a 3-page recipe, I don't think I'm that interested in preparing it.
And what was the one that was something like 2 dozen steps for mashed potatoes?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, we did have one chef on recently who said she deliberately prepared her cookbook for people to cook at home, and she said she really just thought it was unfair of celebrity chefs to be writing the cookbooks they were writing, which were clearly written to be produced in a professional kitchen by a full service culinary team, and were not likely to be successful at home. So that was point of view, and I guess I tend to agree with her.
Yeah, it is a little frustrating, I think, for people that are writing cookbooks today because, boy, if you're on TV, it's a done deal. Everybody wants to publish your cookbook. But if you're just a person that's been in the food industry for a long, long time and has a really good depth of skill and experience, it can be a lot harder to find someone that wants to publish your book.
But once you have it out there, people can count on the fact that if they follow the directions, they get all the ingredients, and they follow the directions, it's going to turn out just right.
That's certainly the plan. I always have other people test my recipes, mainly just friends and my adult children. And I've gotten some really good comments back after they've prepared a recipe, which has helped me have an understanding a little bit more of what people know and don't know, or some terms that are very familiar to people that have been cooking a long time. Younger people have no idea what that means. So you have to really kind of find the right balance to get the right description and use the right word.
I think it's a great job to produce such a well-written, well-researched and well-written book, and we thank you so much for sharing your thoughts about it with us today, Pat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. This has been great fun. I'm sorry, Anne, what?
Good luck with your book.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm very excited about it. I just got my own copy a couple weeks ago, so now I have to go sell it.
All right, Pat. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
But don't you say goodbye just yet, because there's another sub-segment coming up right after the break that I'm sure you'll find very interesting.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
I'm pleased to present you next up with a conversation we had with an esteemed colleague of mine, Miriam Rubin, who is not only a columnist, a food writer in general, a cookbook author, a chef, a trained chef, a farmer. What else does Miriam do? Just about everything. But she's now writing this book that is a subject dear to her heart and to mine. It's called Tomatoes. I'm really enjoying this, or going to enjoy this, being able to interview a colleague of mine, Miriam Rubin. Miriam, I didn't realize you were a CIA grad on top of everything else, right?
Yes, it's true, I am.
Well, good. And also, you were the first woman to work in Four Seasons restaurant?
That's right.
Well, that was something. How long ago? That was a while ago, right?
I can't tell you how long ago.
No, you'd have to kill me. I understand.
It was a while ago, and it was an incredible experience. It was amazing to be there. It was really a shrine to food, and it was when women were not accepted in kitchens at all, and especially in New York and especially in French chef-driven kitchens. Yeah. But due to the lawsuit that Leslie Rev filed against the Waldorf, that's where I got my job, because the Four Seasons was concerned that they were going to get sued next, and they figured they had to get a girl in there, and yeah. I was graduating from school, and I interviewed, and I got the job.
That's fabulous. Now, this has a wonderful one-word title, Tomatoes.
Or
tomatoes, and Miriam can spell it.
I can.
Unlike Dan Quayle, I sometimes get confused over whether there's an E in tomatoes.
Only when it's plural.
Is that right? Okay, only when it's plural. But the intriguing thing about the cover is that you have this absolutely gorgeous red thing on it, and it's got like a shadow on the bottom. How did they manage that?
I don't know.
It's sort of like a little reflection.
Well, they would put a light on it. The photographer would have a scramble.
Oh, okay. Well, it just looks absolutely gorgeous. It makes you want to cut the book open.
It does. And the book inside the cover is red. I just noticed that yesterday. So it's very cute.
It is cute. The whole series, I might mention that this is part of a series, to date, I think, four, right?
There are four. It's part of the Savor the South series, published by the University of North Carolina Press. And the first two books came out last year, Pecans and Buttermilk.
Buttermilk.
Yeah, Buttermilk.
I love it.
That's a wonderful book. They're both wonderful.
So, and I asked you earlier on, you write this column called Miriam's Garden for the Post Gazette, which is our daily paper.
Yes.
And you took off, I had misjudged a number of years ago, to actually work on a farm, your own farm, to work your farm. But I didn't understand your connection to the South, and I asked you, how are you suddenly Southern? Because you're not.
We live in southwestern Pennsylvania.
Yeah, well, that's not it.
No, that's not it. And no, I'm not in the South. I was born in Flint, Michigan, and I'm from Detroit, and I lived in New York for many years, and then I moved to this crazy place where I live. I'm in the woods with my husband, and we live in a log cabin on 88 acres, and we live in paradise. But my connection to the South really is, for a lot of things, it's through the Southern Foodways Alliance.
Yes.
I've just got fascinated with Southern food. I have a huge collection of Southern cookbooks, reference book, and that's one of the connections. The other is also through Southern Foodways. I met Mike Cohen Ferris, who wrote a book called Matzo Ball Gumbo, Culinary Tale of the Jewish
House. I love that title.
It's wonderful, and it's a fascinating book, and it's hilarious, and she's very funny and very erudite. And I was the recipe editor and developer on that book, and that got me acquainted with the University of North Carolina Press.
Who published the series Saving the South. Now, back to tomatoes issue.
Yep.
I always follow your tips when you write your column about the tomatoes, because that's the only crop that really interests me.
You don't like lettuce?
Well, yeah, but that's a no-brainer. I give the seeds to Peter, and he sticks them in the ground.
And usually they don't flourish.
No.
Usually I get a lot of weeds. It's amazing how many weeds you can get out of a package of lettuce seeds.
That's true.
Yeah.
But now, this book, you covered all the side issues of, like, canning, mm-hmm. growing, mm-hmm. and so forth, the tomatoes. And in fact, I was thrilled that you, I don't know if it's a recommendation or not, but you do reference my style of freezing tomatoes. You wash them, you dry them whole, stick them in a plastic freezer bag, and stick them in the freezer.
That's right, and forget about them until it's cooler weather.
Right. That's what I do, and they're wonderful. So now you have here, I would say, like, classic tomato recipe, but they're very much yours. You adapt some from other people's recipe books and recipes, but they're essentially yours, the way you do it, your mayonnaise and your, what you fill tomatoes with. And So talk to us a little bit about how you approach selecting what recipes you're going to include in this book.
Go out in the garden and you look at the tomatoes and you ask what they want to be. Yeah, it's more complicated than that. I wanted to include some really iconic, important Southern recipes. I wanted to have an Appalachian recipe, which is tomato gravy. I wanted to include a tomato jam, which is something I do every single year. Sometimes I do it with several different kinds of tomatoes. But I was looking at tomatoes through the lens of the South. So certain dishes had to be there, like the Bloody Mary and tomato soup and the tomato sandwich. But the point was to put my take on them, to make them the way I wanted to also to pare them down to make them as simple as possible so that the tomato was the star. So that's pretty much my approach to it. And I also wanted to include some more international things, which is why there's a tapenade and there's a matbucha.
Love that. Yeah, I read about that.
Yeah.
And your tomato jalapeno gravy?
Yes, that's based on the Appalachian tomato gravy made in a black skillet. Actually, I don't make it in a black skillet because I didn't like the interplay of the irony flavor.
Yeah, you mentioned that in your book, and I thought, you know, I always cook. I do most of my cooking in cast iron skillets.
I usually do, but for some reason, every time I made that recipe in that pan, all I got was that particular taste
irony
of the pan.
Interesting.
Yeah, maybe mine isn't seasoned with enough bacon fat.
Uh-huh.
It could be.
Could be.
I'm not sure, because I made lots of other things in it. Let's make a pork tenderloin and green tomato biscuit pie in that same pan.
That sounds fabulous.
It is. I'm very proud of that recipe. It was really good.
Now, I was surprised to see the peach and tomato salad with toasted pecans.
Mm-hmm.
I've never put peaches and tomatoes.
That came about during the year of the blight.
Yeah, I remember you pulled all of yours out, didn't you?
I ended up pulling all of mine out. I had a few that were kind of ripening in the barn. But, yeah, that was that sad year. And I think it was a very good year for peaches, but a really bad year for tomatoes. And so what the peaches do, even if the tomatoes are good, is they have this wonderful crispness and a sweetness and a tartness, and it's really an incredible marriage, especially with the onion and the toasted pecans. It's a delicious salad. Ironically, the peach book by Kelly Alexander, the one that's coming out.
Yeah, I have that, but I haven't read it yet.
Well, there's a tomato and peach salad in there, too.
Oh, funny. different author.
Funny.
Yeah, different writer altogether.
Yeah.
Interesting. Just an aside, did you read Tomato Land?
I have read most of it. I've heard him speak.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yes, we interviewed him. We have him on our archives. I was just appalled.
It's a very sad and very scary
story.
Oh,
terrible, awful.
And I think they've made some inroads into changing things. There was some legislation recently so that some Mexicans couldn't be dumping tomatoes into the market, which is a problem, which is keeping the price low.
Uh-huh.
But it's not something I really deal with in the book. But yes, and Barry's wonderful. He's just a wonderful speaker and a really wonderful guy.
He's very motivational too.
Yes.
Now, the tomato book I liked was the guy who moved from New York City to eastern Pennsylvania and grew every kind of tomato you can imagine.
Out of his mind, right.
He was growing such vast numbers of tomatoes in his apartment in New York City that his landlord threatened to throw him out. So they took the tomato plants and drove west until they found a place where they could settle to grow tomatoes.
You know, I don't know that book. Who is that?
I'll have to look him up. I won't look
we'll
him up.
We'll email you. We'll look it up because we interviewed him.
I'll find it somewhere.
He was hysterical.
It's a real funny story. He knew absolutely nothing about tomatoes. And
that's
he just,
wonderful. That's not in my tomato book library. I think it needs to be there.
I promise you I'll try to look it up as soon as we get off the air here.
Thank you.
The other one that I love is I'd like to just look through that one. It's about 4 years.
Amy Goldman's book?
Yeah. Amy Goldman's heirloom tomatoes. Look at the pictures.
I know. It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful.
But Miriam, mine don't look like that. I do all heirlooms, and mine do not look like that.
Well, you know that she selected the prettiest ones.
Yeah, of course.
What kind of tomatoes do you grow?
Ugly ones.
Not the ugly ones. Mm. I order them from Mindy Schwartz, and I order different sizes and different colors. I particularly like black ones and gold, of course, and I let her pick me out an assortment of them.
Our best ones are green ones at the end of the season.
Yeah, we do great with green
ones. Green ones at the end of the season. Last year was not a good season for us again. The year before was a disaster like it was for you. We're praying for a good year in 2013 so that we can make some of these wonderful recipes. And we better start thinking great thoughts about which plants we're going to buy this year and how many of them we're going to put in, sweetheart. So maybe it's time to let Miriam Rubin go off and do the same thing.
Well, I recommend Brandywines. They're
good too.
They came from Pennsylvania.
Right.
They originated in Pennsylvania. So that's a great one to grow. And Cherokee Purple do really well.
Oh, they're beautiful, yes.
And do you know that most of the black tomatoes, except for Cherokee Purple, originated in Russia?
Yes, they're actually listed with the Russian names in Mindy's catalog, yeah. So what's next, Miriam? I don't know when you have time to write when you work. You really work hard on that farm.
Oh, well, I've got a few projects that I am working on and thinking about, but I'm really not ready to say just what's next.
Okay.
What's next is starting the tomato plants.
That's for sure.
and getting the snow to melt and... We're going to buy a new tiller this year and getting the new potatoes in and the onions and starting carrots and beets and things like that.
Well, I mean, I don't know. You do sound like you're in paradise and having a wonderful life, but I do know it's hard work because my mother was a super gardener in our house. So.
Yeah.
Anyhow, it was great talking to you.
It was wonderful talking to you as well.
And we have to call to talk to each other now. You're always busy.
Well, thank you for inviting me to be part of your show.
Okay, Miriam, good talking to you, love. Ciao, ciao.
Bye-bye, thank you.
So there you have it. From
We sure enjoy our guests, don't we?
We do.
So I really like
all the way from cookie crisps via Poland and Scandinavia to tomatoes being grown in southwestern Pennsylvania. What a world-traveling group we are today. But something a little close to home just for fun to finish off. So
yes.
What a pleasure to be able to talk to Miriam. And to talk to these other wonderful ladies. And there was one guy called Peter. You probably noticed there was another Peter crept in.
His wife, Laura,
Yeah, of course. But
anyhow.
Peter got to say almost as many words as I did, so he had a good inning, I guess. And he seemed like he enjoyed himself, and we hope you enjoyed yourselves too. And then we'll see you again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.